Morning, David Donnan on behalf of Mr. Peterson, and I'll hope to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Peterson asked the court to reverse his convictions based on a plethora of errors he's identified both in his statement of additional grounds and his response to the state's pleading, and we also asked for reversal based on the issues raised in the appellant's opening brief. I hope to focus first on the jury trial questions with regard to the peremptory challenges and the denial of the peremptory challenge that Mr. Peterson was entitled to under Criminal Rule 6.5. There's no dispute in the record, I don't believe, certainly between the parties, that Mr. Peterson sought to use the peremptory challenges. The parties, both prosecutor and defense counsel, discussed with Judge Sapira what their understanding of the practice was and the reasons and the policy reasons behind it, and the need for additional peremptory challenge for each of the alternate jurors that were seated. So there was no question about their desire to utilize those. Those alternate jurors ultimately did sit on the panel here and ultimately deliberated to a verdict in this case, and under Vreen, that's plainly structural error in this point. The state argues that Mr. Peterson is not entitled to relief, however, because the issue wasn't preserved. We argue on the contrary, however, there's no waiver here. The judge described her process, that is, how it is that she anticipated conducting voir dire in these cases. The parties outlined for her what their understanding of the rules were,
Did anyone cite to CR 6.5 to the court?
No, Your Honor, they didn't. But I don't believe that's dispositive. I believe if you look at Byrd as the case, as the state cites here, invocation of the particular rule in the context of voir dire itself is not necessary. In Byrd, the court goes through an elaborate discussion both of the colloquy that occurred and then the substance of the sidebar. And in neither of those circumstances is there either an the word objection, for example, interposed, nor a citation to the criminal rules in particular that control the decision, in that case, 6.4.
It seemed that on a flat record, it's hard to tell, but did it seem that the trial judge understood that the parties were in disagreement over the court's proposed procedure?
It did, Your Honor. I believe it is clear in this record. True, and that's, I think, clear in the cases, is to give the court an opportunity or afford the court an opportunity to correct its error, and I believe that was presented here. They offered those opportunities by identifying the options that were available. The court could not seat any alternates. That was something that was within the court's discretion. The court elected not to do that. The court could have called downstairs and gotten more jurors. She elected not to do that, and instead she elected to do what the court rule did not give her discretion to do, and that was to seat the two alternate jurors but to not allow the parties a challenge that was provided for under Criminal Rule 6.5. So the court... I don't know whether she would or not. The rule is quite clear, but whether or not it's waived or whether or not she might have made an alternate decision had the rule specifically been cited to her, I don't believe is dispositive in this case, because not only Byrd gives you a circumstance in which the objection is not noted, simply the desire to have the additional peremptory challenges, and the rule is never invoked in the context of the circumstances of voir dire in that case. The cases that they rely on in Byrd illustrate that point. Wick, for example, says the court, it must be called to the court's attention, but that's not dispositive. What's, I think, most enlightening is the Seattle case that they rely on when they say, what does it mean to call to the court's attention? And they specifically, in that opinion, state Supreme Court opinions say, counsel cannot sit and remain silent. And that did not happen here. They don't get specific about the nature or the specific form that the objection has to take. And I think Judge Finley, in his concurring opinion, really defines what has to happen. He says, specifically pointed out what in the proceedings he deemed to be an irregularity. They identified what they believed to be the irregularity, that they should be provided the additional peremptory challenges for the alternate jurors that were to be seated. They've clearly satisfied then the standard that seems to be laid out by the Supreme Court in the Seattle case as well as in WIC, and then ultimately applied by Byrd here, because they identified what the irregularity was, what the problem was, that we need either additional jurors in order to allow for that if you're going to put the alternates on, because she didn't want to allow them to have the peremptories for the alternates because they were down to only three left at that point, and there was one that was ultimately going to be dismissed almost for cause at that point. And in order to keep the proceedings going, Judge Shapiro made the decision to limit the peremptory challenges. And under that circumstance, the irregularity or the problem was identified for the judge at a point in time at which she had an opportunity to correct that in a variety of different ways, which were outlined there, even without recitation of the rule, and therefore that opportunity within the meaning of the case law, and I think the case law out of this division as well, because when you look to RAP 2.5 and the annotations under RAP 2.5, there are examples of this court providing relief in the appellate context in the absence of an invocation of the rule, either in the trial court or in WIC, for example, where the Supreme Court granted relief on a ground that wasn't even raised until oral argument at the state Supreme Court. So clearly, the specific invocation of the rule is not what's dispositive here. I think what ultimately controls is whether or not the court was made aware of what the problem is, what it was that the parties sought. And in this circumstance, the record is clear that both the prosecutor and the defense attorney identified what the problem was, proposed several alternatives within the construct of the rule, which would have resolved that problem, gave the court an opportunity to avoid the error, and the court declined to. The court instead exercised her discretion on grounds that are simply untenable and unreasonable in light of the mandatory provisions of the statute, and consistent with Byrd, we believe that relief must flow as a result from the structural error after those two alternates were placed on the jury and ultimately deliberated. So for that reason, we ask the court to reverse. We also commend to the court all of the issues that Mr. Peterson has so vigorously presented to the court, particularly the speedy trial problems that are outlined in the briefing.
If you prevail on this issue with the peremptory challenges, do we still need to address those other issues?
I would have to ponder, not the speedy trial issue. He has some misconduct issues. We have a 404B issue with regard to the firearm, so if there's going to be a retrial and some enlightenment on that would certainly be helpful. Oh, I think it certainly could be. It would result in dismissal. I'm sorry, I misspoke.
Well,
we would need to resolve whether or not there was a speedy trial violation, certainly.
Thank you.
My apologies.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Tomas Gann. I represent the state of Washington in this matter. Your Honors, I will focus as well on the issue of the peremptory challenges. I think, Peterson, just as the state concedes there was a rule violation here, I think Peterson also would concede that if there wasn't preservation, that then there is waiver on appeal. So the real only issue that we're discussing with respect to that issue is whether it was preserved. There's sort of been a lot of summarizing the record, a lot of putting what Peterson's attorney said into counsel into our own legal terms. I wouldn't usually belabor the court with this, but I think what was actually said needs to be said now. When the court initially indicated that she did not intend on giving peremptory strikes as to the alternates, that she was only going to give the parties six strikes, the state first said, that's not how I've seen it done before, but I don't have, quote, a specific legal objection. Defense counsel said, in my experience, most courts, not to say it's right or wrong, add additional peremptories for 14 people as opposed to six peremptories for 12 people. Clearly, I think what's important to see is it's not just they're not preserving the error. It's that everybody's talking about this as if it's discretionary. They're inviting this sort of interpretation of the peremptories in light of whether or not in a discretionary light. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I don't have a specific legal objection.
Can you waive a structural error?
Well, let's remember that the source of structural error is federal, and it's almost always at least statutory and usually constitutional. Defense counsel used the word statute to describe the rule here.
It's a court rule-based rule.
And that's all it is. That's the only authority for it, is the court rule. But I guess to answer the court's question, yes. If you look at the federal cases that gave us the term structural error that we started using only in the late 90s, you'll see that preservation of error is still required for those, for the very same reasons of judicial economy. If the court doesn't have an opportunity to remedy it.
Let's take the next step. If it's a structural error, does the waiver have to be knowing?
I don't know. I don't know if the waiver has to be knowing, but I think.
I mean, basically, here is nobody read the rule book before they went to court that day. So nobody could be accused of having knowledge of the rule and saying, we don't care what the rule says, we're willing to go with the pool we have.
How would we ever determine?
But we usually do it with a colloquy. You understand you have a right to an alternate juror.
Right.
You're going to delay the trial a day. You say you want to get going today. Are you willing to give it up? Be a knowing waiver. But this is a defendant's right. There's no indication that either he or his counsel were aware of what the rule provided. There doesn't seem to be much indication that the prosecutor and the trial judge were either.
Well, I couldn't find an example of structural error in any of the federal cases that use the term. Byrd and Wiki don't use it. I couldn't find an example of a structural error where it wasn't preserved for whatever reason, and they didn't. Well, sure. Remember, we're only talking.
And that's a constitutional error,
right,
rather than a court case, right? But that's still got the label structural error.
None of the progeny of cases that rely just on peremptory strikes, for example, that are rule based, I don't think you'll find any language that says you can never fail to preserve it and somehow not waive it because they didn't know. And the truth is, if there was any sort of objection, and I don't think this jives with the language in Byrd, it's true that, at least from what we can tell of the record in Byrd, the defense counsel never said, Your Honor, I object. But what he did say is, waiving the panel isn't the same as burning my peremptories. And that's right. It's not the same, and the rule says that. He didn't invoke the rule, but he made it very clear that he disagreed with the court's ruling. If we follow the record even past when defense counsel says not to say it's right or wrong, the judge actually accommodates because she thinks it's discretionary. She accommodates the parties, and then they get to when they actually have to lose that because there's just not enough jurors left, and the court and counsel count up the remaining jurors, and they say, we don't have enough to give you those strikes. Defense explicitly says, after realizing they only have 27 jurors, so we would still have the problem of either the court needing to say only six peremptories. She's suggesting that it's discretionary. And then the court jumps on it, and then they're done. There's nothing like Byrd, where a defense attorney raises it twice, once in the middle and once at the end. There's really no comparison to what happens in Byrd. And I think the reason, whether it's structural error or any other type of error, the reason that preservation matters so much is really highlighted in this case. I mean, sure, it's an inconvenience to call up some additional jurors, but that's all it is.
What if counsel just said, I object, that's not what the defendant's rights entitled to, they haven't cited the rule?
That would have been sufficient, because at that point.
Do you think the outcome would have been any
different? Oh, yes. I think that if anybody.
What suggests to you the outcome would have been different absent the citation?
That the judge said, I think I have discretion to do this, and that everyone else seemed consistent with that, I think it's clear the judge thought she had discretion to do this. If anyone had indicated they didn't, it would take 2 seconds to Westlaw the rule, to type in peremptories and see what the rule is. And once that's done, and that's why counsel didn't raise ineffective assistance for not preserving the error. Because the truth is that once that error was preserved, it would have been remedied. Once there was an actual objection that would have allowed somebody to pick up the book and read it, just like the judge did in Byrd, but it was too late in the game, they would have seen the rule. And as this court already said, the rule is shall. So I don't think there's any question that if this would have been raised, even raised lightly, even raised in the same manner as Byrd, instead of suggested all the time by all parties that this was discretionary, it could have been easily remedied. They could have called up more jurors, and we wouldn't be here today on this issue. The court's, I don't believe, going to find any examples of language this soft where an alternative discretionary solution is proposed being considered preservation. For that reason, Your Honor, it's the state's position that this is the one argument that seems compelling, but this argument still fails. And unless the court has any more questions, I'll cede the remainder of my time. Thank you, Your Honors.
We would certainly encourage the court not to go trying to read too much into some of the language there. For example, defense counsel does say, I'm not pronouncing any moral judgment on the rule of what the other people are doing, say, in a seven or six or however many, but that doesn't constitute a waiver. She's not making some sort of moral choice about the nature of the rule in the same way she's not making any sort of particular value judgment about any other statutory or prosecutorial decision or any of the other things that she doesn't have control over. That narrow phrase certainly doesn't constitute the sort of acquiescence that's envisioned, and it certainly stands in stark contrast to what happens in Byrd, where they sit there and they go back over the math and determine that, now that I understand how you did your math and that's how you're going to count it, okay, there's still at that point no reference to the rule and there's no interposition of any sort of objection at that point. There's simply a description, as there is in this particular case, about a desire to have the peremptory challenges that are, as we know now, in both circumstances, expressly provided for by the rule. This is not a question of inviting the court to exercise discretion that it did not have. There were invitations of the court to exercise the discretion that was provided in common practice, and those are outlined from the beginning on the 8th through the 13th, and those were, you could not seat any alternates. That would make the problem go away. You could go get other people. To look at the one sentence, which is on page 43 that counsel just mentioned, where she says, we have this problem, the court needing to say only six peremptories, or she's cut off at that point before she can complete the sentence, and Judge Shapira at that point says, then I'm going with the six, and that's what we're going to do for here. There are still the alternates in that circumstance, and under that particular circumstance, the error had been identified, the problem, the irregularity in the proceedings within the meaning of the preservation case law that the state Supreme Court has given us, and under those circumstances, the error, structural as it is here, is entitled, Mr. Peterson is entitled to relief for that, and we ask the court to grant him that relief. Thank you.
Thank you.